Our next guest on Counterpoint is Christopher Walter Monckton, the Viscount Monckton of Brenchley. Lord Monckton is highly critical of the anthropogenic global warming orthodoxy, and he played a role in an October 2007 legal action which aimed to prevent Al Gore's documentary An Inconvenient Truth from being shown in English schools. Now, shortly before the Copenhagen Climate Conference, the Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd, delivered a speech to the Lowy Institute about climate change sceptics, in which he referred to Lord Monckton six times. A response entitled An Open Letter to Australian Prime Minister Rudd was published by the Science and Public Policy Institute on the 3rd of January 2010. On the eve of his Australian tour, I asked him to outline his principal message.
What I'm going to say is that you need to have a royal commission now to reassess climate science. I mean, look what's happened just in the last few months. We've had the ClimateGate emails revealing that all of the principal players in the IPCC who have been most articulate and most forthright in pushing the notion that climate change may prove catastrophic have been linked together in what can only be described as a small but powerful conspiracy to bend, distort, invent, manufacture, fabricate, budge, shift, tamper with, tinker with, and even destroy scientific evidence for the sake of oversexing the dossier, to use an old phrase. So I'm going to say, first of all, that now needs to be reassessed, and it's got to be done by an independent Royal Commission. Don't let the scientists do it on their own. You've got to pull in people from outside science to see whether the scientists are actually telling the truth and whether, even however passionately they may themselves believe what they're saying about the climate, whether they actually really know, because the uncertainties in all this are far greater than the UN's climate panel would like to admit. So that's part one of my message. Part two is that you really don't want to go down the ETS route. An emissions trading scheme would be the largest tax in the history of Australia. It would have zero benefit to the climate. It would basically make no difference to it at all. It would cost trillions to no good purpose. And the only people who would benefit are absolute bankers. Is that really what you want?
Now, your critics, you have many. And Tim Lambert, for example, says, look, you only take low-range data to reach a conclusion that catastrophes probably won't happen. Then, of course, alarmists, it could be said, only use worst-case data. So how does a member of the public balance these two competing claims?
That's a very fair and sensible and proportionate question. You have people shrieking at you from both directions, and you wonder who on earth is right. And that, if you like, is the policymaker's dilemma. Let me declare, first of all, so everybody knows exactly what the truth is, I am not a scientist. Yes, I'm a reasonably competent mathematician, and mathematics is the language of science, which means I can understand the scientific papers I read on this subject. But I'm not a scientist myself. So when you're listening to me, I will say to you now on the air what I say whenever I begin my lectures, and I will be saying this all the way across Australia, and that is, do not believe a word I say. I am not here to proselytise or preach. What I am here to do is to point out to you that we're not just in the territory of uncertainty now. We now know that the effect of CO2 in causing warming, though it is a real effect, is a very small and harmless and beneficial one. How do we know? Well, first of all, we need to look at the last 150 years of temperature data. That's called the instrumental record. Now, the only reliable part of that data is from about 1980 onwards, when satellites were up there checking it. And if you look at that period, and if you take the period between 1983 specifically and 2001, that's the only period in the recent record that we could have influenced, because there just wasn't enough CO2 being put out by us before then. Now, from 1983 to 2001, there was rapid warming, which stopped in 2001, since when there has been rapid cooling. Now, that period of sustained rapid warming, which is exactly parallel to and at the same warming rate as 1860 to 1880 or 1910 to 1940, so there's nothing unprecedented in it. That period of warming, what caused it? We can't tell what caused the previous two periods of warming at a similar rate, equivalent to 1.6 Celsius per century, just over those short periods. We don't know what caused those because we didn't have enough instruments to look at the time. Now we do. We have satellites up there that can monitor what is happening in particular to outgoing radiation, which is what the debate is all about. We can also see what's happening to clouds. And the key paper on this is Pinker et al., 2005. Now, Pinker is not even a climate scientist. He's not involved in the global warming debate. He doesn't mention global warming in this paper, which is why I find it such impressive testimony. But what he says is that he is an expert in working out whether satellites can tell us things about what's going on down here. And one of the things he found is that between 1983 and 2001, and particularly during the 1990s, there was a continuing, entirely natural, unconnected with anything we're doing, decline in cloud cover. Now, if you have fewer clouds over you here in Australia, it gets hotter, right? Very, very simple. So he then worked out what was the radiative forcing in watts per square metre from this naturally occurring change in cloud cover. He found it was 3 watts per square metre, compared with, at maximum, 0.8 watts per square metre for CO2 and all other anthropogenic influences on the climate during that period. Therefore, 4 times as much warming was caused in that period by natural factors than by anthropogenic man-made factors. And from that, it's a relatively simple calculation because we know there was 0.45 Celsius of warming over that period of 19 years, to work out what amount of warming a doubling of CO2 would cause. And the answer is 0.43 Celsius and not the 3.3 that the UN imagines. Now, less than half a degree Celsius is not a problem. Now, that is a measured result. And the rule in science is that measurement always trumps models. And it's the only measurement of its kind that we have so far.
Well, let's move from science to politics.
Certainly.
During the northern autumn of 2009, you embarked on a tour of North America to issue a warning against, and I quote, the binding implications that could follow for countries that signed the proposed Copenhagen Treaty. Now, what specifically concerned you about the draft document?
This draft treaty, which was dated September the 15th, and it had been buried where you couldn't really find it on a UN website, and a talented colleague of mine noticed that a note by the Secretariat appeared to be rather longer than a note should be, and he found annexed to the 2-page note was a 168-page treaty draft, which had not been issued to the world. But there it was. He sent it straight to me, and I read it and was horrified to find that at paragraph 38 of Annex 1, there were two references, and very clear references, to the establishment of a world government. The word government actually appeared in that context twice, and it's the first time I've seen the word government appear in that context in any global treaty. And I've negotiated, written, interpreted global treaties for a long time, so I know of what I speak. So I was horrified at this, particularly because this world government was going to be given enormous powers to regulate all markets. There'd be no such thing as free markets anymore. They were going to transfer the operation of all markets to the control of this world government. It was going to have enormous powers of taxation and of regulation, not only in the environmental field, but right across. It was going to take control of the commanding heights of the economy of the West. And yet, in these 186 pages, the words democracy, ballot, vote, election do not occur even once. Why? Because they were wanting to set up a dictatorial government. It's long been the ambition of totalitarians on every side, and here they thought they were going to get away with it. So I screamed and shouted and said, this treaty draft exists. Once again, don't believe a word I say. Go and look it up. If you think I've misinterpreted it, fine. But this is what I think it means. And 4 million people have now seen the speech in which I first announced that this treaty existed. And enormous numbers of them got on to their senators, both here and in, of course, the United States of America, and said, this treaty shall not pass. And by the time Copenhagen began, they'd already backed off from trying to pursue that draft, and they came out instead with the damp squib, which is the Copenhagen Accord, a very different animal, far less dangerous, still expensive enough and still entirely pointless, but at least we're not going to have our democracy taken away this year.
Let's look at that damp squib. President Obama flew in, flew out. Nothing binding was agreed. So what happens to cap and trade in America now?
Well, I think the significant thing there is the election result in Massachusetts, where for the first time in since 1972, a Republican has taken a Massachusetts Senate seat in a very hard-fought contest by actually quite an impressive 5% majority. So he won it quite convincingly. And the Republicans in the Senate are now hardening their line, not just by going against climate change on the economics, which everyone except Lord Stern agrees simply doesn't add up. There's no way it's worthwhile to mitigate carbon emissions. Much, much better to wait and see whether you get any problem and then adapt to it if you do. That's the smart thing to do. But I think, therefore, that they're not only arguing that economic point, they're now beginning to get into the scientific point. I've had letters copied to me from a couple of senators just while I'm here in Australia, writing to the administration and asking them difficult questions about the science. And that's the first time any major political party has systematically started asking questions about the science of the scientists who had previously just lectured to it and said, you've got to believe this. I'll give you an example of this. When Sir David King, then the government science advisor in the UK, went in front of the Environment Committee of the House of Commons on the 30th of March 2005, he told them, the first thing he said was, half the ice at the South Pole has gone. And those dumplings sat and looked at him, and not one of them asked him, what on earth do you mean? In fact, none of the ice at the South Pole has gone. It's 8,850 feet deep last time I measured it, and it's still accumulating.
What about China post-Copenhagen? Are they going to do anything different? Or?
China played a very interesting role. First of all, before Copenhagen, China got together with India and South Africa and Brazil. And these were the forthright four who got together. And they said, one, we're not going to have any compulsory emissions cuts because our people are poor and the fastest way to get them out of poverty is to burn fossil fuels. And if that emits CO2, well, at least we'll stabilize our populations by making them more prosperous. That was point one. Point two, they said, if you want us to make any emissions cuts, you in the West have got to pay. Point three, we will not accept any verification or monitoring of any emissions cuts we make unless those are cuts that you're paying for in the West. And four, we're not going to have climate change used as an excuse for reintroducing protectionism and prevention of free trade in our goods. They took that line. And President Obama, and I was there, he went in and spent nearly an hour for 55 minutes with Wen Jiabao, who's the president of the State Council of China, who went to Copenhagen. And at Copenhagen, they had this meeting of nearly an hour. And at the end of that, Wen Jiabao told Obama, I am not going to vary from the policy which I and these other countries have agreed. And he went straight out onto the stage and told them so. And I knew then that all was over and we're not going to get this binding treaty this year. They are going to try again in Mexico next year. We're not yet out of the wood. So those Australians who are listening to this, who happen to believe in the old-fashioned concept of democracy, which I happen to love, then watch out, because your governing class would still quite like to hand your powers of election over to an unelected world government if they possibly could. And you must stop them.
Now, since Copenhagen, a lot has happened. The BBC, for one, has announced that it will carry out a probe into, quote, the accuracy and impartiality of its science reporting. Does that surprise you?
It surprises me very much that they have finally admitted that there's something wrong with the BBC's coverage. It has been relentlessly biased and really flagrantly biased to a degree that I haven't seen among any other broadcaster. I mean, most other broadcasters, even if they tend to have a general proclivity towards the totalitarianism, towards being not merely mirrors but poodles of the governing establishment of the day, would nevertheless at least retain a little modicum of distance so that they could occasionally allow the other side to be heard. The BBC virtually never allowed the other side to be heard on this question. And they developed a marvellous variety of excuses for why they shouldn't have balance on this question. And finally, so many people complained, including me, to the BBC Trust, that it has now given in and accepted that if the BBC is to retain its right to levy a £2 billion licence fee tax on the population, then it's going to have to justify itself as still retaining the independence that its charter requires. And I welcome this inquiry, and I hope it will be straight.
Now, looking at the BBC and broadening it out to journalism in general, In commentary about climate, sceptic has become a dirty word, especially for journalists. And yet, you have crafted and trained as a journalist. Journalists pride themselves on their sceptical approach to the utterances of politicians.
They used to.
Why has the IPCC had such a dream run?
I think it's because what you've got here is a conspiracy, and I use this in a very wide sense, not in a too conspiratorial sense, of the governing class worldwide against the governed, the rich against the poor, the powerful against the weak, the big guy against the little guy. This is the age-old struggle, actually, of government and politics. And the great triumph of the United States Constitution, which had such a profound influence all around the world, including back in our own country and in Australia, is in saying that the little guy, the guy with the vote, should prevail. And this, to the chattering classes, has always been something that they've never quite liked. They've had to tolerate it, but they don't like the possibility, if you're a politician, of being thrown out by the electors. And so there's always a very strong tendency, and I'm not talking of right or left here, it's strong right across politics, to minimise the role of democracy and maximise the role of the politician, regardless of whether he's been elected to his post or not. And what has happened here is that the IPCC came along just at the moment when a number of strands of thinking, particularly in Western countries, were moving away from allowing democracy because the people were regarded, frankly, as too stupid to be allowed to vote on things. And therefore it all had to be done by we, the politicians, who were cleverer than they were. Not a point of view I agree with, but it was a very widely spoken point of view among governing circles worldwide. So when the IPCC came along and said, right, we need a world government, we need to deal with this major issue, a lot of politicians who were in search of an issue said, ah, now we can stand up and make speeches about saving the planet, no less. That makes us really sound important. So a number of interests came together. Bankers in particular wanted to make a fortune out of carbon trading. All the boys with red braces in the City of London who call it trading hot air, they were all there. The school teachers wanted to motivate their kids to save the planet from the sins of their parents. What could be more appealing for kids than a story like that? The media, for whom you'll always sell more newspapers or advertising space if you say world to end shock than if you tell the truth, which is climate continuing changeable, yawn. And so you put all these interests together. And therefore, it's not so much a conspiracy as a coalition of interests, all of whom wanted this to be true, while at one part of them there was still a kind of corner of sanity somewhere saying, well, actually, we don't want this to be true. The fact is, it isn't true. And what has happened is the ordinary people have begun to smell, I can't use the word on the air, but it doesn't smell very nice. They've smelt the propaganda, the sheer hysteria of those who have been trying to promote this scare, and their unwillingness to debate. So what we're seeing now is a collapse in this belief system, as it was. It had become a kind of religion. And to take your point about scepticism, which is where you started with this question, T.H. Huxley, when he was debating with Bishop Soapy Sam Wilberforce, this was back in 1860, on the question of evolution, in the great hall of the Oxford Museum of Natural History. A huge crowd gathered. And Huxley stood up and said this, to the improver of natural knowledge, that was his phrase for a scientist, the improver of natural knowledge, he said, does not recognise authority as such. For him, scepticism, and he used the word scepticism, is the highest of duties, blind faith, the one unpardonable sin. And I agree.
Well, this weekend, there's some more clouds that have appeared with relation to hurricanes and floods. The IPCC has stated that the link to global warming of hurricanes and floods has perhaps been overstated. The vice chairman of the IPCC said the UN body was now reassessing the evidence. And the author who wrote the original report, a Mr. Robert Muir Wood, he was a contributing author of the IPCC report, he said, the idea that catastrophes are rising in cost because of climate change is completely misleading. So again, we have some problems here with hurricanes and floods.
Now, this is very interesting because the original error about hurricanes and floods came from, once again, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, the one on whom all the terrestrial temperature records depend. And I testified in front of Congress 6 months ago alongside Tom Carl, who is the director of the National Climatic Data Centre, which is a subdivision of NOAA, which produces all this hurricane material. And I had said in front of the Congress that, in fact, there was no link between warmer weather and hurricanes, and that indeed as proof of this, NOAA were saying there's been 0.6 to 0.7 Celsius of warming over the last 100 years, but the number of land-falling Atlantic hurricanes on the coast of the United States during that time had remained absolutely constant right across the period, no trend at all. Tom Carl tried to say that I wasn't telling the truth. And so he got out a chart to show to the congressman, and his own chart showed that I was, in fact, wrong in one respect. It wasn't 100 years, it was 150 years, for which they had records of land-falling hurricanes, which had shown no trend. So how did he then try to get round the point? He said, but look at the last 30 years, where there's been a huge increase in non-hurricane tropical storms. And I said, yes, because 30 years ago they introduced satellite monitoring, and the increase you're seeing there is purely an artifact of the better method of measurement, and you know it. And he had the grace to blush. He then went on. I produced a graph showing that there had been global cooling since 2001. Very, very sharp global cooling on all measures. And he was asked by Joe Barton, the ranking minority member on the committee I was appearing in front of, which was the Energy and Commerce Committee, was asked, is Lord Monckton lying to us? Here we've had all these officials, like yourself, coming in front of us for months telling us global warming's a problem, and we now get told by a peer from the United Kingdom that, in fact, we've had 9 years global cooling. Would you care to explain? And so Tom Carl flannelled, and he said, well, I wouldn't quite put it like that. So we were both asked to write to the committee to justify our positions. And I wrote, simply sending a graph where I'd plotted the data from Tom Carl's own NCDC global temperature data set. And it showed a very clear, very decisive decline in temperatures over the nine-year period. And so what we've got is these people making money, these scientists, out of pretending there's a problem, giving bogus facts, even in front of their own elected officials. We've seen it with David King in London. We've seen it with Tom Carl there in the States. I've seen it over and over again. Straightforward falsehoods being put in front of elected representatives who are then misled. But when I'm there, they don't get away with it because I've gone back and checked the actual data and plotted it for myself. That's the way science is or ought to be done.
Well, let's stick with the UK and look to the future. Ed Miliband, the UK Climate Change Secretary of State. He says that the UN talks in Mexico at the end of the year are likely to produce, and I quote, a legally binding climate change treaty. Is he on the money?
That's what he said just before the Copenhagen conference, and it didn't happen. There is, however, and we mustn't get triumphalist or complacent here, there is a danger that this momentum to set up a world government via a binding treaty, using the climate as the Trojan horse, as the excuse for doing this, may yet succeed. I will, of course, be going to Mexico to do what I did at Copenhagen and try to talk to the delegates and say, look, for heaven's sake, the science doesn't add up. Don't throw away the future development of the Earth by going down this road. There are so many real environmental problems that need to be dealt with. Deforestation, which I was talking to the Prince of Wales about the other day. I mean, there he's right, he's wrong about the climate, he's right about that. You've got the encroachment of humanity on the fragile habitats of so many of our fellow creatures. You've got overfishing of the oceans. These are real problems that need to be addressed, and where, if we were to start throwing billions or trillions around, let's at least spend them on the real problems and not on what is now near universally recognised by all sane people to be the non-problem of climate change.
Christopher Walter Monckton, the Viscount Monckton of Brenchley, who is starting an Australian lecture tour this week. A link to his pamphlet, an open letter to Australian Prime Minister Rudd, will be posted on the Counterpoint website. That's abc.net.au/rn/counterpoint.
But anyhow, here's the story of Waltzing Matilda.
Ever get misty-eyed about what it means to live in this great brown land? Maybe belt out a few drunken verses of Waltzing Matilda. But what do we really know about the song and its suicidal shearer? There's intrigue, industrial warfare, maybe even murder. We're going big and digging deep into the nation's unofficial anthem. The Matilda Myth, on air, online, even a competition. Coming soon to ABC Radio National.
Now, before we leave you today, a preview of next week's program when I'll be interviewing Bob Bottom, who, of course, is one of the most influential crime fighters Australia has ever seen. As a journalist and author, Bottom alerted the public to the growing importance of organised crime back in the 70s and 80s and prompted the setting up of half a dozen royal commissions. No mean achievement. Bob retired long ago, but now he's returning to the public arena because he believes we've lost some of our capacity to fight organised crime. In the past, his stance against organised crime meant that threats to his personal safety could be very real. Here's a quick preview.
Yes, there were a period, particularly in the 1970s, for the first Royal Commission. That was the Moffat Royal Commission in New South Wales. They were very scary times. I was the first citizen, actually, in Australia to be afforded protection by the Australian Federal Police, who lived in my house, and we had 24-hour guards for some time. And for many years after that, we had a sort of rotating system of various police and then ultimately, you know, private security firms would maintain 24-hour patrols.
Yeah, I noticed in the book you say that this went on for something like 11 years.
Yes, it did, actually, and then there'd been the odd incident since. But in the current terms, I have a more settled life.
Glad to hear it. In light of all of this, how serious do you think the threat of organised crime is today compared with, say, back in the 80s?
Oh, I think it's worse. Some parts of it have changed, and that is the old power revolving around SP bookmaking has gone. It still revolves around the vice trade because the most lucrative market for hardline drugs in Australia is for prostitutes, and that is supplying them. And more particularly, anyway, to get to the drugs, it's this upsurge in drug use in Australia. Do you know, this is another interesting thing. When the NCA was formed in 1984, for the next 5 years, we actually turned the tables and we were actually starting to win the drug war. But then there was intervention on the basis of harm minimisation, partly, you know, justifiably to reduce AIDS. But then a lot of the authorities sort of lost the plot a little bit. But we now have a situation where the drug trade in Australia is more entrenched than it's ever been. There are various arrests of various people, but mainly at the distributor level. There are some major arrests involving importers, but unfortunately, not the ACC nor state police are now targeting the true Mr. Biggs.
Bob Bottom, legendary crime fighter, on Counterpoint next week.
Also on next week's show, our resident commentator and satirist Patrick Cook. That man again, he's back with his humorous portrayal of the body politic.
But that's it for us this week. Our first week back live, armed and dangerous for 2010. Counterpoint's produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is John Magic Fingers Diamond. I'm Michael Duffy.
And I'm Paul Comrie-Thompson. Coming up next, the ABC Radio National News.